The opinions expressed on the ACB Media Network are those of the respective program contributors and cannot be assumed to serve as endorsements of products or views of the American Council of the Blind, its elected officials, or its staff.
BPI presents Pride Connection. Sponsored by Blind LGBT Pride International, Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern on ACB Media One, and shortly thereafter on all your favorite podcast catchers.
And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, they're only illusions, and rainbows have nothing.
Greetings, BPI community. I am dropping in with a brief president's message from the outskirts of the Miami Pride celebration.
Woo-hoo!
Anthony, Gabe, and I will be marching within the next hour or so in this wonderful Pride parade with the Flamenco Dems. I don't know what position we are in the parade. But
we're in the 50s.
I don't know how many floats there are. It reminds me of going to San Francisco Pride when I think the first year I was there, we were in 87th place with the Lighthouse of San Francisco. But anyway, I hope you enjoy today's artistic programming courtesy of Jessica Tomlinson and her top-notch hosting skills. But I wanted to just encourage everybody, given that Pride season is beginning here in Florida, some of the Pride celebrations are not in June because the heat of June is quite oppressive. I believe that the Fort Lauderdale celebration will be at the end of April. Orlando will be in October. And all across the country, there'll be many Pride festivities in June, of course. So I wanted to encourage all of you, particularly given the political climate right now in the United States, if you can, please, please attend and represent at your various Pride events. It is really important that we be out there and be visible this year and remind people that we are not going away and we are strident in our pride for who we are, and we believe in ourselves and our strength and our families. So I ask all of you to please get out there if at all possible, and if you can, please record some snippets of your Pride experiences so that we could put together a montage of different Pride events from across the country.
Woo-hoo!
So with that, I will leave you in Jessica's hands, and I hope all of you have a wonderful, spectacular Pride season.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Pride Connection, sponsored by Blind LGBT Pride. Today we have a very special guest, Diane Collin of Arts Ably. Arts Ably is an organization that provides lectures, training materials, and other resources to help make music classrooms, performance spaces, and other arts venues accessible to people with many different types of disabilities. Arts Ably even has a podcast called Arts Ably, which I was honored to be interviewed on just recently. So I encourage everybody to check out the Arts Ably podcast, where you will find interviews from a lot of people studying, making, and working in many fields related to the arts. Diane, welcome. When we did our interview, we started by doing brief visual descriptions of ourselves. Shall we start with that?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Okay, so my name is Diane, and I am a woman with glasses. I am right now, I'm talking from my home office. I have short hair. I have a black top. You can just imagine myself in my little office. I have a keyboard, the piano behind me, and I have lots of books because I love reading and studying. Yeah, that's it for the visual description, I guess.
Thank you very much. We also have two other panelists with us today. We have Shannon Dyer and we have Natalia. Would either of you like to say a brief introduction of yourself and what you do and anything that you want to promote, and also maybe describe yourselves a little bit?
Sure. I'm Shannon Dyer and I am in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I am currently recording this from my living room. I studied classical voice in college and did some work in that space for a while in New York City. Now I, because of some health issues, have been out of the performance space for quite a while, but I am deeply committed to seeing some accessibility changes be made, especially in classical arenas, but in all arenas of the arts, really. I have shoulder length, dark hair, blue eyes, and right now I'm curled up under a blanket and I have a sleeping tabby cat in my lap.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. And Natalia, would you like to go next?
Sure. So I'm Natalia Solka. I live in Miami, Florida, where it's a breezy, 80 degrees right now. Nice and warm. I'm currently in my office on my computer. And I was a vocal piano performance major in college, and I worked a lot in music doing pop, Latin pop, some jazz. And currently I'm kind of settled into teaching voice lessons and performing in private gigs, mostly weddings, parties, and different churches. For right now, I am Latina, so my skin is probably like coffee and milk. I have now shoulder-length black hair because I did cut it off. But I'm looking forward to being here today and appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much. And I am Jessica Tomlinson. I am in St. Petersburg, Florida, and it is also very nice weather here. We had quite the epic apocalyptic storm earlier today, but it is all cleared up and it's sunshine and birds singing and the wind is blowing. I graduated in 2004 from the Full Sail Recording Arts program and then went on to study education. And I'm now an assistive technology instructor at Lighthouse of Pinellas, but I also love to play the piano and sing and dabble in production and recording arts on the computer using Reaper and other tools and materials. I am a white woman with shoulder-length brown hair. I'm currently wearing a yellow sundress and I'm at my computer desk, and behind me is a digital piano keyboard on a fun purple stand, and the second tier has a shorter synthesizer keyboard. Okay, welcome everybody. I'm glad that we were able to set the scene a little bit and introduce ourselves. I would like to know the story behind Arts Ably and how the organization started and if there's an origin story.
There is. Actually, I love story behind stories. I'm a musicologist. I didn't tell that, but I am also a music major. I studied musicology and music performance and performance. I also studied theater in France, where I come from originally. And I was a specialist of Ludwig van Beethoven, and I also became a specialist of Franz Liszt, and two people that are very important in my life. And of course, with the Beethoven studies, I started studying the impact of disability on his music. In France, it stayed with me for a long time. And then a few years later, I was able to continue this work in Canada, where I am right now. I am in Toronto, in Canada. And it's been 10 years I'm living there. And for the 10 years I've lived there, I've been doing many things, including coming back to performances, which I stopped for a particular reason, is that I have a neurological disease and I ended up being in a wheelchair when I was in France. I grew up walking and then I was using crutches and then I used a wheelchair. When I was in France, the lack of accessibility in all European countries really impacted my studies and my progression in the arts. But when I arrived in Canada, then I was able to start over and to go back to the music and go back to my studies and go back to musical practices. I did a lot of gigs and choirs, choral music. I love community music and choirs. I love that. And I started applying to finish, to complete the master I didn't finish in France. I went to York University thanks to someone who became a guide in my life called Stephanie Martin. She's a Canadian composer, and she was the choir director of one of the choirs I was singing in. And she's also a professor at York University. And one day we were talking, and she said, why don't you apply for your master and finish it in Toronto? And I did, and I got admitted. I finished my master in 1 year because I already had all that previous research about Beethoven. And from that research, I wanted to do something modern. I wanted to, I say to myself, okay, I've done enough Beethoven studies. I still love Beethoven, but I want to see what is happening to musicians with disabilities today and what are the impacts. And I discovered a field called critical disability studies, academic field. And I started studying the music in relation to critical disability studies and the application on real life performers and people mostly in North America and in Europe. And this constituted my master's thesis, which I completed in 2021. And my Stephanie Martin, still her, said to me, well, you're going to complete it early, so why don't you apply for a PhD? I applied for the PhD, and during this PhD research, since 2021, I've been doing a lot of different things, working with theaters, working with choirs, working with orchestras for them to work on their own notion of accessibility in music. Also, historically, I've improved everything I did on the master, continued the things, continued to interview musicians. And then I had the opportunity to get some funding to create workshops to allow students in a music school to discover what it is to have accessible instruments and what it is to have an ASL performance of a song. With adaptive instruments, we worked with different groups of ages of children on the notions of how to play music differently, how to play a guitar with feet and no arms, or drums. This was fun. They had a lot of fun doing that. How to read music differently. So we did a workshop about Braille music and reading scores in Braille. And then we did this ASL workshop where with the Braille workshop, I worked a bit with CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind in Toronto. And then for the ASL workshop, I worked with an ASL music performer in Toronto called Gayatri Prasad. And she was awesome with the children. And we learned The Greatest by Sia in sign language. And this was done in a final performance at the end of the year of the school. And so I got invited to do several workshops, to talk with the teachers, to do professional development workshops with the teachers, to talk with the administration, was able to talk with the parents about that concept. And the director of the school in which I did the workshop, before that, I had the opportunity to work with them for another project, and he hired me as a voice teacher. So now I am a teacher over there, but I still want to develop these workshops. And when I started thinking, okay, I have enough elements now to try to build a project with all these things I have developed during my PhD and make it available outside the university. And I decided to think of this Arts AB project ahead and give it a structure and contact, get some trainings? What would it mean to create a company? And in Toronto, we get a lot of help on that. The City of Toronto provides some helps for auto entrepreneurs and for small companies and budgets and things like that. And I started in February, almost 3 months ago. I started putting together all these projects, putting together a website, working on the accessibility of the website because I wanted this website to be accessible to everybody, launching it officially February 8th. And then I got a lot of support from my colleagues and from my friends who were believing that this project could work. I got I got my first fundraiser together, and then it was done. And now I have contact with multiple organizations, and I'm creating partnerships. I was hired to do a workshop with an organization called Xenia Concerts in July, who is an organization working with audience with autism. I was hired to do an accessibility assessment for a new project of a music room that will be open to the community, even outside university. In a university in Ontario. So multiple projects like that are starting to build up here and there. And I'm very happy that some people trust me. And so I started also this podcast with the idea that this platform could also be an open platform to give an opportunity to artists to present their work, and I publish resources for each episode and things like that. And that's basically how it starts. It's now we are at the beginning, but I have the feeling that there are multiple ways where it could go right now.
Well, all that is really wonderful. It's great to hear that story and all that you do. And I know the community is really going to benefit from that work. And I also understand that Toronto is quite the cultural center for disability studies and disability rights. I've recently listened to the book called Care Work, Dreaming Disability Justice by Leah Lakshmi, and there are passing mentions of many, many great and wonderful organizations in Toronto featuring people of many different types of disabilities. So thank you for sharing that. I would like to ask the panelists now, Shannon and Natalia, I believe that each of you have some music university level study. Could you tell us if you ran into any accessibility pitfalls during your studies and how you were able to either ask for accommodations or come up with your own creative solutions to move around those and continue and make things work for you?
So I was in college, I'm dating myself here, in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so I was in that space where technology, both just for, you know, non-musical studies as well as both in music, was starting to become more accessible, but really wasn't there yet. And for me, I struggled to upload like scores. You know, we had to create different types of musical scores. I struggled to do that with the limited screen reader support that I had at the time. I was able to understand like Braille music to a degree, but to sort of take that knowledge from like music on paper and sort of translate that into doing it digitally, uploading that stuff on the computer, creating things using pieces of software that were not really designed to work with screen readers was difficult. There was, at that point, not a lot of great Braille support for these things. And so I did struggle with that aspect of it. And I ended up having to get like readers and scribes to help you know, make those things happen. As far as like the actual performances, I think the biggest accessibility barrier that I found was mostly in just the expectations of what people thought I could do or would do as a person with no vision. And I did find it difficult. You know, we had certain requirements in the classical performance space that I was being educated in that, you know, you would take part in a certain number of performances, both at the university and also just within the community. And I did struggle to find those because there were a lot of people in that time who were not very keen to take a chance on a blind performer, you know, a college student. I had a dog at the time. And, you know, people were kind of like, oh, like a guide dog, you know, what are we going to do with that? And so it was not necessarily the most welcoming space. I have heard from various people that this is a little different now, especially in non-classical recording spaces, but performance spaces. But it was difficult and not, I would say, not very, you know, welcoming or supportive. I had good support from my university, but I think even they kind of thought there was only, you know, so much that they could do or were willing to do.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I'm very sorry to hear about that experience, mainly about other people and their attitudes and expectations. I found that was also true from a very technical perspective in the studio recording engineering field as well. I am 4'9" and I'm very feminine presenting and I'm visually impaired and I'm female. So me walking into the studio toting my step stool so I can reach the top shelf of the gear rack, it doesn't look like I can succeed in a boys' club. So I've had to find my own way and basically work on my own and continue learning on my own because that traditional top-down, label-funded, large studio model is not as prevalent anymore because of the internet and social media, but also that has benefited people like me as well who don't look like industry insiders. Natalia, did you have anything to add to this?
Well, I finished school in 2015. So when I went to school, I went to music school somewhere where it was all Macs. And at the time, Macs were accessible, but not music software. So not Pro Tools, not GarageBand, not Logic, not notating software, neither Sibelius nor Finale were accessible at the time. And so I had to use Windows in a music school where everybody was using Mac. So that already kind of put me on a separate scale from everyone else. And because I was using Windows, I had to use music software that was either obsolete or music software that could do the same things that Pro Tools and GarageBand were doing or that my classmates were expected to do, but not at the same level or at the same scale. So it was pretty interesting. Everybody would look at my computer like, oh, you have Windows. But the good thing about it, the cool thing about it, was that for the first time in my life, I was not the first blind person. I was not the first blind student teachers had. And it was nice to be able to find myself musically with every accessibility thing either solved for me or the workaround had already been found for it before me. That being said, there were pitfalls outside of school and in school. As far as what Shannon said, expectations, I can relate a lot to that. I had a lot of trouble because actually for me it was easier in the classical field, but in the non-classical pop field where there are things expected like choreography, even if you're in a choral setting or even a church choir setting, a gospel choir setting, there are visual expectations, and sometimes I wasn't even given the opportunity to try, and that was hard. or just, I guess, different things that weren't even asked of me because it was just assumed that they weren't possible. And then afterwards, when it came to my career and I would try to get jobs that I was qualified for example, I would be hired and then I would show up and they'd see, you know, this woman with a cane and visually impaired, and I wouldn't hear back again. So that was interesting, but I have made it work for me in the best way that I can. And I have always been fortunate enough that I have found work, but I definitely agree that there's a lot of work that we can do and a lot of things that we can do so that we can be judged on our musicality and nothing else, as it should be.
Thank you so much. Yes, I agree. There's still a lot of work to do. I didn't know if maybe, Diane, did you want to add some of your experiences as a university student?
Yes, with pleasure. Actually, as a university and a non-university student, because and as a teacher, as a university teacher, because with a PhD, I teach. And so now I find myself in the position of not having power because I'm a teacher assistant, which is not, we don't have a lot of possibilities in terms of making sure everything is accessible, but we can try. So what I did, first of all, is to make sure that my expectations were heard in terms of accommodation. So as a student, I did my own accommodation requests. And in any university, I'm sure Shannon and Natalia, you had a similar experience. When you do accommodation in a program where you have to fight to have your accommodation respected, you have to be in the process or be in the system as a recognized disabled person on campus. And the process itself in universities, it's something that is very difficult to follow, and you have to go to a lot of steps to have your stamp on a paper that says, okay, you're now officially approved. You can send the request to the professors that you are a disabled person and that you need accommodation. Thanks. I could have gone to the professor and directly tell that, but okay, why not? And then you are here in the stages in university. They try to do, especially today and especially in Canada, they really try to make sure that the stages are accessible. So that is in university. Outside university, totally different stories. You want to perform most of the stages in churches or in cultural centers or artistic venues are not accessible or are accessible, but the elevator doesn't work. Accessible, but you have three steps. Accessible, but the choristers are above and not under. Or not on the stage, but they are on the balcony where you should climb three steps on the bottom to be able to go. I lived that a lot. And so I wanted to make sure in my discussions with these organizations that if they, for example, rent a ramp, which happened, they rent the right ramp. They rent a ramp that is long enough or doesn't have a big slope in order for a wheelchair or someone with a mobility device to pass. But then most of these venues are not accessible to visually impaired people. There are obstacles all around, things like that. So now they know me as a rolling person, but I encourage them to think of other kinds of disabilities and other kind of obstacles that people having any kind of disability or difference experience in the performing arts. And now for the third part, me as a teacher, I had to do my accommodations request in order to teach in these classrooms. Okay, none of the department, the music department in York when I arrived, had a door that would open automatically. You had to press or push very heavy doors to get inside the studios. You had no equipment because, oh, the equipments are normally reserved in this room where you have like these amphitheaters. that are not always very accessible. And so it was a lot of effort. And believe it or not, I was on campus last week for the first time for a period of time before, for a reason. Right now, there is a strike on campus. And so for some time, I didn't go on campus. But they took advantage of this time to finalize the last little bits of accessibility, which was to implement automatic doors on our floor. And now I have an automatic door in my office. And I have an automatic door in the studio, performance studio, and in the classroom where I teach, and in the other classes where I go. But this was the result of 4 years of back and forth discussions, emails saying, where are you in the process again? And then the administration is changing, and then you have to find a new person. And you have a meeting, and the person is saying, okay, so it's going to be done in 3 months, and then 6 months later, it's not done, and you have to follow back again. So as a result, if you're not a person who has a strong voice like I am, nothing is happening. And most of the people don't have strong voice like I have. So I'm happy to be able to help on that part. But I'm thinking of someone who is more introverted or shy or not someone who would necessarily defend themselves or defend the fact that they have to have a recognized disability in order to be in the program. All these are sometimes very tiring. And well, I'm almost at the end of my PhD, so I will be happy to finish with the successfully implemented accessibility that we asked for so many years. And so as a teacher, I was able to make sure that all my students who needed things, who needed extra hours, who needed more time to practice, we needed to rest because they had 3 concerts in a row in the week. Things like that needs to be taken into account by professors. And we really need to value the mental health and position of the students who is running here and there and doing a lot of things, especially in performing arts. For me, it was an opening eyes on different aspects that I didn't really consider when I was simply a student.
Well, congratulations on almost finishing your PhD. That's great news. And I also have heard from others and have also learned myself that we truly learn and internalize and become a part of something that we are teaching to others, because the process of teaching requires us to very much think something through and break it down into all of its component parts and allows us to really come to know the material in a whole new way. So thank you for that. Some of us here on this call today also consider ourselves part of the LGBT community. I, for one, like to sing pop songs or keeping the she pronouns for a love interest. So, for instance, the country song, She's Got It All, or another country song I've been singing lately, That Girl Is Going, Going, Gone. And a lot of times I hold my breath and I worry, how is this going to go over if I sing in a bar with a bunch of drunk dudes staring me down? And what is the audience that I'm performing in front of? How are they going to receive this coming from me? Is this a friendly audience? And sometimes it's hard to tell. So a lot of times if I have someone sighted helping me, driving me to the gig or helping me load in my gear in or out, I will say, what do you think about these people? What's their vibe? What do they look like? How do you think they're going to be? How do you think they're going to receive what I'm putting down? So I just wanted to ask all of you if any of you have had similar thoughts or experiences or reservations being in a performing space, depending on the genre or the field or the environment, if you are someone who is a part of that community.
Okay, so I'm also part of the LGBT community, and I'm also a sharer, and I am not, to say, an active member. Like, I am not a club person, for example. I don't like, I'm in a wheelchair. I don't like a lot of crowd around me. But we have a great village in Toronto, and it's in a church, and it's in a street called Church Street. And it's great that it's in Church Street, because we arrive in Church Street, the first thing we see are churches. And then the street continues, and then there are flags all over the place, and there are colorful things. There is the local library, a bookshop, and then there are all these clubs. And I love drag shows. I love drag shows. I find it more vibrant, interesting. I love the interaction with, and funny. And so I was thinking of the pandemic period with someone who I know well. We went to some drag shows that were happening during the pandemic. By the time nobody could go out, the only little thing that was happening in one of these neighborhoods was the house of a drag artist, and she was performing on her upper part of the steps all the time, I don't know if it was once a week or something like that. And the whole neighborhood was invited to join from a distance to have something artistic and to have something vibrant and something from the community and something just to have some joy in this moment where we were all locked in our homes. And because we were all trying to like get out and do a walk and go around this is one of the most fantastic memories I keep from this lockdown period. And I have some very talented drag friends and artists who, when you see them, you wouldn't guess one single minute that they are drag artists. And I love that too, the fact that there are, especially in classical music, you know, when you see these standards and these, we need to be this way and that way, and we need to present correctly, and we need to have a dress, and we need to blah, blah, blah. When you're a woman, I never wore a dress of my life. I always wear pants. And when I have to discuss with someone about that, I say, well, it's like that. I wear pants. I'm thinking of one artist that I know particularly well, who, when you see him play his classical gigs, you wouldn't guess a minute that he's also a talented drag artist behind. And I love that. I love that kind of vibrant life.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing. I very much appreciate that. Anyone else with anything to add?
When I was performing, I was not that sort of brave standout person that was going to pop out on stage and be like, okay, here I am, not only a woman with a disability, but also a lesbian. Like, that was just not a thing at the time that I was comfortable doing. And I never got the impression that in the classical circles that I traveled in, that would have been accepted. I kind of felt like I was pushing the envelope as just a blind person trying to come in and do these things that I chose. And sometimes I regret that now, you know, so many years on. But I did choose sort of not to purposely make that a part of myself that I was putting out there. In some cases, you know, it didn't feel important. You know, when I was in school, for example, I went to a small Catholic university. So that was not, you know, going to be like a good thing to do. But I also felt like in, you know, the music that I was performing, which was, you know, pieces from operas and other types of art songs, I didn't feel that it was necessary or important at that time. I think had I gone to school, you know, even like 10 years later, the climate might have been a little different and I might have made different choices. But where I stand, you know, where I stood at that time, it did not feel like safe, necessary, or prudent to come out in that way.
Well, I totally understand that. And I certainly appreciate how that must have been. And certainly for the music that you were performing, I have heard other people tell me that music in opera is extremely gendered. And
yes,
people in the opera world have very essentialist ideas for which genders are going to be which voice parts. And who is going to wear what clothes and who is going to play what roles. And I just think that is very outdated and really needs an update. Like, Opera needs to go, like, if it were a computer, we need to update it to, like, Windows 11 or, you know, whatever the latest information is on being open to more flexible gender roles and more flexible people having different voice parts. I even heard an interview. It was a trans woman in musical theater. And even in the musical theater world, the directors were unwilling to transpose the songs to other keys that would fit her voice better. Because, oh, this is the way it's always been, and this is how I'm gonna keep it. And I just wanted to jump up and down and scream. I said, we really need to update our ideas on what is for whom and who is welcome and who is allowed. I just wanted to bring it back to, I love the fact that we have so many talented people here today that have done so much work in the arts and music, particularly around disability. I wanted to ask you all what work, I mean, I know we've talked a lot about some things we've experienced, but what is work that you would like to see done in the near future? What is the next step that venues and universities and organizations can take?
I would say that for a lot of universities and performance spaces here in the U.S., especially in the Midwest and the East Coast, where I spent most of my time, we'll just forget about the years I spent in Texas, that I think one of the things is we need to make accessibility less of an afterthought. You know, people come up with their ideas and then they try to build accessibility in after. And I think considering accessibility along with everything else that you're considering when you're coming up with a show or, you know, trying to figure out the best way to perform a piece of music, I think all of these things need to be considered together. So that accessibility is built in, you know, kind of from the ground up. I think incorporating things like ASL interpreting and visual interpreting, you know, in operas and musical theater events, and even like art exhibits, if we're talking about, you know, more like painting and sculpture. I think creating all of these things with accessibility in mind, rather than trying to put it in later, is key. And something that I don't see happening nearly as much as I think it should.
I agree with Shannon. And I would say, in addition to that, that sometimes it comes with the lack of knowledge of people. They just don't know. And suddenly they realize, if we point out the fact that, well, it was built not accessible. Oh, yeah. And this could, accessibility is not an add-on. It could be thought before, and then it's universal design that is here to help us make something that is accessible to everybody, accessible to strollers, accessible to someone who travels with a suitcase. I don't know who this person would be to come with a suitcase in a theater, but why not? You know what? I don't know. It's something when you start discussing with people and when you start advocating and making them realize, well, accessibility is something else than just adding some accessibility over something that is already built. It's something else. It's creating a better future. It's considering all kinds of accesses, access needs. Is considering the growing population that is getting older, and we're all going there. Everybody's going to have a kind of a disability before they die. So, just thinking of the diverse possibilities that we have to think that we have to consider in the arts. It's not only about pure accessibility, it's about everything that is around the building, everything that is around being in a safe space, having a a green room where, or a room where someone can rest, or I would say a less rigidity in the arts. That's what I want to see. Open to more audiences, open to more artists. Not considering that accessibility is for the audience only. Accessibility is also for the performers. But this comes with discussions, and sometimes people don't guess because, as Shannon said, it was not in the conversations in the past, but now it is.
That's actually what I was going to mention, since you mentioned accessibility for the audiences, that accessibility, I think, has to start somewhere. And where do we start? The problem with lack of accessibility, in my opinion, and I was just talking about this yesterday, is not that it doesn't exist. Of course, that's a problem. The reason it doesn't exist is because people don't think it has to exist. And why? Because people don't know there's a need for it, right? And you can't work something into an idea when you don't know about it. And where can we start this? We need to start it by seeing more disabled performers on the stage, by giving more disabled performers the opportunity to perform based on what they're giving us in their performances, since we're talking about music, based on their musicality and not based on what we expect that they're going to give us because of a judgment. I will give you an example. I've spent my entire life performing, and I have always shocked people. And I work really hard. I'm not saying that my performance doesn't deserve the accolades that I've received. I'm not saying that. I worked really hard to get where I am. But I can also say that a lot of the shock from people has been, wow, that blind lady can sing, or she can play the piano. How does she do that? You know, and the reason this is happening, there's a lot of blind musicians in the world. So, you know, why am I the first one that a lot of people see, right? So there has to be more of us present, and on any stage, on acting stages, on theater stages, and that's going to be what's going to bring the idea forward that, hey, maybe we need to make this something that everyone can use. And I feel that in a lot of things that have to talk about diversity, accessibility, discrimination, disability is not in the conversation, and the arts does not fall behind that either. Even though the arts is supposed to be where everybody belongs, it has not always been that way for, I'm sure I can safely say, all of us here. And I can also safely say that a lot of the auditions that I have done personally and the things I have wanted to do where I have received rejections have been, well, for different reasons, but I can guarantee that a lot of them have to do with the fact that I'm a blind person. And so I think that the more people see us in the fabric of arts as they see everyone else, the more awareness there is and the more there's going to be room for growth in the conversation about what accessibility is going to be and how it's going to be implemented in every facet of the arts.
I actually want to give a shout out to an organization in the United States called ROMPT, Recording Artists and Music Professionals with Disabilities. And this was founded by two musicians, a singer who is blind called Lachi. She's a Latina singer, and a singer and violinist called Galen Lee, who is a wheelchair user, but she does multiple things in terms of activism, and they both are engaged in a lot. They both do a lot of activism activities, and their website is called rompt.org, if I remember correctly.
Is that spelled R-A-M-P-D?
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
So no E, R-A-M-P-D. It kind of sounds like amped, but without the E and an R at the beginning.
Yes. And they did a little play on the name. It's a mix between the romp itself and the fact to be romped when you have a disability and to have some kind of access. and probably some other musical aspects of it, like the amp and things like that. And Robt has been created 2 years ago, and their main partner is the Grammy Awards, is the Recording Academy. They did the accessibility of the Recording Academy, the last one, the last Grammy Awards. And they are fantastic. They just try to get more artists, professional artists, but also community artists. They try to give these networks opportunities to perform, to be visible, to launch conversations, to be part of roundtables. And it's all performers of all different kinds. And I'm part of ROMT. They are not only in the States. They open to all performers with disabilities. And it's a fantastic organization. I really love it.
Yes, I also love that organization. And that's how we actually met, through their newsletter.
That's true.
Does anybody else want to shout out any other organizations or talk about any other projects that you're working on or anything else that you would like to promote? Shannon, I don't know if you want to talk about your podcast a little bit.
So the podcast that I do is a book podcast, and Natalia has been a big part of that almost from the beginning. But it is, I don't know, do we consider like books to be kind of part of that arts?
I think so, because creative writing is part of the arts.
It is. Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right. So we are the Book Bistro podcast, and it is a group of very passionate readers. All of us happen to be blind. That wasn't originally how I designed it, but it has worked out that way. And we talk about books on various themes. We talk about different genres, and we do talk a lot about the ways in which technology has made reading so much more accessible in the world today.
Yes, it's definitely been a pleasure to be part of the podcast. And, you know, I never thought about it, but it is true that we're all blind.
Visually impaired.
It just happened that way. It's very funny, but we are very passionate about our books. And accessibility definitely fits into it, because even, I don't know, 15 years ago, I mean, Shannon and I, even we met because we both used to scan books for Bookshare.
Yes. Yes. Literally scanning actual print books.
By page. Yes. Actual print books lining up to the scanner and pressing down and making sure that there were no errors and all these things that we take for granted now that publishers just hand out the books. Both, you know, and waiting for Braille books and waiting for audiobooks to come out is something that we can both remember quite clearly. It just wasn't long.
Yes.
It wasn't so long ago that we don't remember what it was like. So just saying, hey, this book is coming out Tuesday and I can read it at 3 a.m. with everyone else is pretty awesome. And I'm sure we mentioned it a lot in the podcast.
That is really amazing.
Also, I think that what is great with that kind of project and with the fact to let people know that this new audiobook or this new book is coming. I love audiobooks and I'm not blind. I love audiobooks just because someone reads it to me and someone
yes.
and it's usually an actor and it has a good voice and it's like, this is nice and cozy.
Yes, it goes to show that accessibility benefits all of us.
I mean, even if I wasn't blind, I would love audiobooks because the way I like to read, if I read even in Braille or printed books, I would never get anything done.
Oh, no.
Right.
You know, Shannon would know. I truly would just never get anything done. I would not be a productive member of society. It really is an addiction.
It just goes to show that accessibility benefits all of us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Anything else that anyone would like to say in closing?
Well, thank you for this conversation, because I really appreciated your different perspectives. And Jessica, we had the occasion to talk a little bit, and Shannon and Natalia, I'm really glad to know some other singers and artists of the communities who are experiencing some things that we all, the four of us, can experience in the performing spaces. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much for being here and for sharing the work that you have done to make performance, even just, you know, the littlest bit more accessible.
Yes, thank you so much for letting me be part of this conversation. It was really nice to learn about what you do for Arts Ably, and I'm very glad that a company like this, an organization like this exists. It's definitely needed, and I'm sure you'll do great things in the future. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here and to participate in the conversation today.
All right, sounds wonderful. Thanks everyone for being here.
I've heard it too many times to ignore it.
You've been listening to Pride Connection, sponsored by Blind LGBT Pride International. For more information, please visit our brand new website, bpi.gay. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.